turn to Mark 1, 21 to 34. We're carrying on our series. We're going through the book of Mark, and it's loosely based on Tim Keller's book, King's Cross. And as we're working through the book, we're seeing Mark introducing us to Jesus and introducing Jesus as King. And throughout the book, we're going to see him as King, but ultimately pointing to the cross at the end of the book. Mark's one of the shortest gospels, well, it's the shortest one, and it's an action-packed gospel. It mainly talks about Jesus' actions rather than his actual words, and he uses a word quite a bit in the book, immediately. As you read through it, you'll see he says, immediately this, immediately that. It's a breathless pace that he runs through. He seems to be desperate to get us to know Jesus as he really is, in order that we can have a relationship. We need to have a decision by the end of this book of who Jesus is. There's a lot of current thinking in the world and in churches where the person of Jesus is being watered down. Jesus is being made safe. He's being made politically correct. We're moulding Jesus to fit us. But you can never have a fruitful or rewarding relationship if it's constructed completely on what's favourable to you, to what's most comfortable and accommodating to you. We can't have a genuine relationship with anyone if it's just on our terms. If you came to me, as most of you know, I'm a dentist. If you came to me and you might be nervous of going to the dentist, and you might come and you might have holes in your teeth. But if I was just to say what you wanted to hear, you come see me, oh, there's nothing wrong with your teeth, you're fine, you don't need to come back for another year. That wouldn't be a proper patient-dentist relationship, would it? You'd want me to be honest and say, well, actually, you've got a few holes and we need to treat this now before you start end up with a raging toothache or a swollen face. To have a genuine relationship, we've got to look at all the aspects, even the things that might make us a bit uncomfortable. And today, in today's passage, we're looking at Jesus, and in particular, Jesus' authority. I grew up in the northwest of England in the 80s and 90s, and people of authority, people quite anti-authority. I don't know what you picture, if it's the police or a teacher or even the government. And sometimes we can see authority as not being a good thing. Even the dictionary definition defines it as authority is the power or right to give orders, make decisions, and enforce obedience. Something doesn't sound great, does it, there? We might see authority as something else. You might see it as academic authority. So someone who's very knowledgeable, like a professor in an area, he's an authority teaching about that. Or as in the medical profession, there's someone who's a high-up consultant and they're an authority in that subject. As we look through this passage, we're going to see Jesus as a new authority. We're going to see Jesus' authority in his teaching. We're going to see Jesus performing an exorcism and see Jesus' authority over the spiritual realm. But we're also going to see Jesus performing a healing. Jesus' authority over sickness. Even more so, Jesus' authority over the physical realm. I'm just going to read through the passage there. Have you got it? They went to Capernaum, and when the Sabbath came, Jesus went to the synagogue and began to teach. The people were amazed at his teaching, because he taught them as one who had authority, not as the teachers of the law. Just then, a man in their synagogue who was possessed by an impure spirit cried out, "What do you want with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." "Be quiet," said Jesus sternly. "Come out of him." The impure spirit shook the man violently and came out of him with a shriek. The people were so amazed that they asked each other, "What is this? A new teaching and with authority. He even gives orders to impure spirits and they obey him." News spread quickly over the whole region of Galilee. Can't speak this morning. As soon as they left the synagogue, they went with James and John to the home of Simon and Andrew. Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and they immediately told Jesus about her. So he went to her, took her hand, and helped her up. The fever left her, and she began to wait on them. That evening, after sunset, the people brought to Jesus all the sick and demon-possessed. The whole town gathered at the door, and Jesus healed many who had various diseases. He also drove out many demons, but he would not let the demons speak because they knew who he was. In the first couple of verses, in verses 21 and 22, we see Jesus going into the synagogue on the Sabbath, and he begins to teach, and they're amazed by his teaching because he teaches with authority. What's interesting in the passage, Mark doesn't say anything about what he was actually teaching on. We don't know how eloquently Jesus spoke. We don't really know much, but we know that Jesus spoke with authority that was different to the scribes or the teachers of the law. The teachers of the law would have been people who had studied, equivalent of going to Bible school, would have known the scriptures inside out. They would speak with authority, but the authority would come from someone else. It'd be a knowledge. It'd be an understanding. When Jesus spoke, he spoke with authority. The word that's used here means power. It means rule. It means dominion. When Jesus spoke, his authority was power. The actual translation means out of the original stuff. Whereas other people taught from what they'd learned from other people, Jesus taught out of the original stuff. We get our word author from here. I don't like Harry Potter, got to be honest. Never read any of the books, seen the films. I can't quite see how people get so excited about it. People do get excited. They read the books, they join the forums, and they talk all about it. And people become experts in Harry Potter or authorities in Harry Potter. And it's like, oh, what do you think the meaning behind this is? What do you think this means? Every now and again, the author J.K. Rowling will do interviews and will speak, and she'll give insight when questions are asked. What were her thoughts behind the different bits that she wrote? She is the ultimate authority on Harry Potter because she created it in her own mind. She knows what she was thinking, what the emphasis was there. This is how Jesus teaches with authority, as if he is the author of the Bible, the author of the scriptures, the author of creation itself. So when he comes with this authority. This word, again, is used elsewhere in the Bible, in particular in Daniel 7. We see a vision of a coming kingdom, a peaceable kingdom, a kingdom that will last forever, a perfect kingdom where there'll be no wars, no civil wars, no sickness, no disease. This perfect kingdom coming with this same authority. What Mark is saying here, this kingdom has arrived and is coming. This authority on earth is now here. But it's not just ideas in our head. It's not just a philosophy. Jesus next, and it's quite a disturbing little bit of the passage, performs an exorcism. This would have been unseen by the people. We can get used to ideas if we read the Bible or there's films where people possess that kind of thing. We're used to the idea that it's possible that people expel spirits. They wouldn't have seen anything like this before. This is why, what is this new authority? And you can see what Jesus' authority was like. There's no hocus pocus. There's no ritual. There's no smoke. Jesus talks, commands, and the spirit leaves. Some of you most of you probably got no problem with the idea of a spiritual realm, of angels and demons, and we're in the church, obviously, of God, that there's more to the natural, there's a supernatural realm. Some of you might think, well, actually, really, in this day and age of science and discovery, are we really to believe in angels and demons? Are we really supposed to believe in ultimate good and ultimate evil, that there's more to the physical world than what we see? There can't be more to the natural world. This idea is a relatively new idea in history. It's only about 200 years old, but what we see is what we get. And it's also mainly limited to the Western world, and particularly what we call the educated Western world. But this mindset, and a lot of people debate it, is actually intellectually narrow. It's arrogant. And also personally, and for a lot of people, it's just not satisfying. If there is no super to the natural, if there is no God, there is nothing other than what we have, then your life and my life is nothing but the result of a random collision of molecules, natural selection, the accumulation of genetic advantageous adaptations, and basically the propagation of the species through survival of the fittest. It's a bit depressing. It's also very biased against the strong. It's only the top that are going to survive, that it works for. If there's nothing beyond this world, then this is our outlook. But if you go to other parts of the world, if you go to places where they've seen great atrocities, if you went over and said, where there's been genocide, and you said, actually, what's happened here, it's just a result of natural selection. It's just the thinning down of the gene pool. The weaker are being taken out. It's offensive. It's not only, it's just not satisfying. There's a Lieutenant General Romero Dallaire, who was part of the UN mission to Rwanda and witnessed the genocide, and he was asked how he could still believe in God, and he replied, "I know there is a God because in Rwanda I shook hands with the devil. I have seen him, I have smelled him, and I have touched him. I know the devil exists, and therefore I know there is a God." If there's nothing outside the natural realm, if there's nothing, then everything's just, it's just pointless. If there's nothing, what we have with God is that we know any injustice that goes past all this will one day be rectified, that God's kingdom is coming, that things will change. We can bring it closer to home. As I said, it is depressing. If there's nothing else, then our life is just a random dance of molecules, a random collision of atoms that made it out of the primordial soup. And we just get by surviving, getting advantage over others, and just propagating the species. I've taken this example from a sermon I heard. It was brilliant. There was an article in the National Geographic magazine, and it was about the biochemistry of love. And it was about the different stages of love and the different chemicals and hormones that rush around. So you've got the infatuation stage, or when you've been with someone for long term. And in this, there was a picture, and it was a couple on the stairs of a church, and the bride was all in white and the man in the tuxedo, and it had this little bit written underneath. "Embraced by every culture, marriage sweeps up yet another wedding, another couple up in a wedding in Italy. Newlyweds may gush about perfect love, but to anthropologist Helen Fisher, pair bonding is ultimately driven by the mating instinct wired into the most primitive part of our brains. Look at the joy on this man's face," Fisher says. "He has won the most important thing in his life, the opportunity to pass along his DNA." Don't think he'll get a job writing any love songs anytime soon, this one. When you take everything out of it, you're just left with that. I think Ed Sheeran's job's safe, unfortunately. But not gonna get a job writing any Hallmark cards or anything like that. There's got to be more to life than the physical. Even scientists now are doing, and I can't understand it, are doing weird kind of like experiments, and they're coming to the conclusion that there is more behind this. There is another dimension to what's going on. There's weird theories that does reality actually exist? Are we just all part of one big hologram? Weird, weird ideas. We know there is a dimension behind this, and it's a spiritual dimension. And Jesus has authority over it. We see Jesus, as I say, no smells or anything. It's an impure spirit, or in some of the translations, an unclean spirit. That doesn't mean it's an unhygienic or a dirty kind of spirit. It goes back to the Old Testament, where something was said to be unclean, that it, like a food or something, it didn't belong there. It was an alien presence. Basically, people seem to think that these spirits aren't just floating around in the air, but they latch on into someone, and they just pre-existing character traits and that bring them out. So if someone's an angry, they bring out the anger even more, they magnify. The fact that the spirit knew Jesus and tried to address Jesus, the commentators suggest that the spirit was trying to have some kind of power over Jesus by addressing his name, but nothing happened. But Jesus was able to address and remove. And we see later on in the Leicester passages that Jesus drove out many demons in other people as well, the beginning of this ministry. But what's unusual and what stands out, Jesus silenced them, doesn't want them telling people who he is. If that was me, you'd be like, the more the merrier. If people, it's kind of testimony to who I am. It's making it obvious who I am. A lot of the commentators say that this is just Jesus authorizing a form of crowd control. That you see throughout the gospel that Jesus purposely tried to drive down the number of people that were coming to him. And this is madness in our eyes, because you think the bigger the crowd, the bigger the authority. If you've got a political party, the more people that are following you, the more the authority. Jesus knew far more than that. Authority isn't to do with the people that are following you. The healings that we see in this passage and the driving out of the spirit were just minor skirmishes in a bigger war. Jesus knew ultimately the way to silence the demons was to hand over his authority on the cross, to die. The complete opposite. It wasn't to get bigger and bigger crowds and work through everyone and cast all the demons. It was to do that one sacrifice for all. When the demon comes out, it says the impulse... The impure spirit shook the man violently and came out with him with a shriek. In some of the translations, it says with a loud cry. And it's almost exactly the same as when Jesus died on the cross in Mark 15. It says, with a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. Literally, his breath or his spirit left him. Jesus didn't put up any resistance like we had with this spirit. It wasn't involuntary like it was with the unclean spirit. Jesus went to the cross to breathe out his spirit so he could breathe it into us. He could breathe him into us so his spirit could be in us. So this battle, this ultimate authority could be won. It's not just the spiritual world where we see Jesus has authority though. We see it in the physical world. Jesus' authority isn't just a philosophy, an idea. It isn't just some spirituality. Jesus' authority is in the natural world here now. We see it with the healing. Went to with James and John to the home of Simon and Andrew. Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and Jesus went, helped her out, and healed her. Jesus has authority over sickness. But much more than that, he has authority over this life and the planet we live on. What we do in our life matters. A lot of religions, what we do on this earth, it doesn't matter. The earth's going to burn up. It's just a spiritual concept. Christianity is different because what we do in the here and now matters to God. Our relationships, our work, our God-given dreams, how we care for one another, how we care for society and how we care for our planet matters. Jesus was coming, this kingdom was coming, this gospel message, this new authority was coming. Jesus was coming into the world to heal the world, to heal the sickness, but to mend, to restore in the talk heard, to reweave. A lot of people think in Revelation, when we talk about the new heaven and a new earth, it's not just a new planet, but it's the ultimate restoration of this planet here, that from the fall we had a perfect relationship with God. We submitted to Jesus's authority, to God's authority, and as humans when we fell, we rejected God's authority and took on our own. And it wasn't just a fall for mankind, but it was a fall for the planet. It was a fall for everything. Everything began to decay. Jesus was coming with this authority to reverse that. In Ecclesiastes, Solomon says, what is broken cannot be fixed. He looks at the world and he finds why he can't get satisfaction in anything, in his pleasures, in his all his money. And he just realizes the whole world's broken. That there's nothing, I can't do anything to gain pleasure. He can't gain anything. It's only through God and through God's authority and pursuing God that this can be brought back. C.S. Lewis wrote on this, for Christianity is a fighting religion. It thinks God made the world, that in space and time, he made heat and cold, and he made the colours and tastes, all the animals and vegetables, are things God made up out of his head, as a man makes up a story. But it also insists that a great many things have gone wrong with the world, and that God made, and that God insists, and insists very loudly on our putting them right again. We're not, as Christians, we're not just head in the clouds, philosophy, or all spiritual things. What we do with our time, our interactions with one another, matter greatly. And that we can come under this new authority, that we don't have to go the way of the world. We submit our own authority and go under Jesus's. How do we, after we've looked at this, how do we respond to Jesus's authority? Well, we see, we can't really tell in this passage what happened to a lot of the people. The person who had the impure spirit, we don't know what happened. All this crowd and the whole town that gathered, we don't really know, but we know what happened to Simon's mother-in-law. I was going to put mother-in-law jokes in, but I just left that out today. When Jesus healed her, she had a fever, and he went and touched her, and she was healed. But the words used, it's not as good in the NIV translation. He took her hand and helped her up. It literally means he raised her. In a lot of the miracles that Jesus does in Mark's gospel, blind Bartimaeus, the paralyzed man, almost a lot of them, the same words used. When he performs a healing, he raises them up. And it's the same word that's used for Jesus when he is risen. He is raised up. When we come under Jesus' authority, he raises us up. We don't stay where we were. He pulls us up. He grabs us by the hand and raises us up. There's a Christian song I quite like, and the words go like this. The fear that held us now gives away to him who is our peace. His final breath upon the cross is now alive in me. Your name is victory. All praise will rise to Christ our King. And this is it. By your spirit I will rise from the ashes of defeat. The resurrected King is resurrecting me. In your name I come alive to declare your victory. The resurrecting King is resurrecting me. Jesus came into the world to raise us up. But why did he raise us up? And we see this is Simon's mother-in-law. He rose her up. I can't see this part in the passage. Took her by the hand, and immediately she began to wait on them. She didn't go off and do all the stuff that she was couldn't do when she was sick. She got up and waited on Jesus. She served. I had a tummy bug the other week. And whenever I'm off sick from work, I just can't relax. Because in my head, I'm going through, oh, they've had to cancel my patients. Or have they got a locum in? Oh, I bet it's all chaos at work. It's all going to be chaos when I get back. And I spend the day stressing out when I should just be relaxing or trying to get better. When she was healed, she got up and served Jesus immediately. Jesus raises us up, lifts us up in order to serve. Not in order because we owe anything or to gain anything. We do it because Jesus has raised us up. We want to. We live a life that we were called to serve him, not to pay anything back. And this was just in a quiet time I was looking at. Jesus calls you to rise up and become fully alive in order to live, to bring hope to your family, friends, work, colleagues, and the world. The resurrection power is within you. Paul writes to the Church of Rome, if the spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead is living in you, he who raised Christ from the dead will also give to you your mortal bodies because of his spirit who lives in you. The resurrection of Jesus Christ is the basis of your future hopes. Your plans, what you want to do with your life, submit it to Jesus' authority. This power, this rule, this kingdom. Excellent. Just like to pray. Lord Jesus, we submit to your authority. Not any of the authorities of the world or our own, Lord, that the only true authority is you. I thank you for just the response these people had, that compared to the scribes who'd been educated, that you, who just seemed just to be a carpenter from Nazareth, had such authority. Authority over the spirit. I pray for anyone who's in a spiritual battle right now, that we claim your authority, Lord Jesus. in the physical world, if it's work or related, that we claim your authority, Lord, in order that we can be raised up and serve you, Lord. Amen. Amen.